Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight is another very interesting and great show, I hope, dealing with the revealing of new information about time and space. Now, new comes from me. This is not new in the field of physics, although I will be talking about what has happened in the last 5 to 10 years or so of physics, and as it has found out some of the things that are interesting and new to physics about time and space. Although tonight, this is a show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, so of course, I'm going to be revealing things that are metaphysical and spiritual, as well as maybe in the future physics about time and space. And if you're interested at all in how our universe actually came into being and how it works, this is the show you'll be listening to. Now, some of you might say, well, how come I should listen to this guy? Well, I'm going to give you some reasons. Now, it's going to sound like I'm tooting my horn maybe or something like that, but it's accurate at any rate. You can take it for whatever you want. But if we go back in time, I love going back in time in a show about time, and we were to investigate where I was coming from some time ago, say about 1990 or so, I had written an article called Cycles in Time, gave several lectures dealing with the subject in the very early 90s. And at that time, I, through this article and the lectures, made a number of, amazingly, if I can say so, accurate predictions about how the universe functions. Now, this is before physics, the modern-day physics of that time, had an explanation for the things that I explained. And some of those things included concepts that later on were discovered to be true due to improvements in telescopes and the way that we can decipher information coming from us from distant parts of the universe, going all the way back to the beginning of time itself, in the beginning of our universe. And because of those measurements and theories being developed and eventually proven or sometimes disproven, it was determined that the universe was formed sometime around 13.7, give or take, billion years ago. Maybe more than that, though. A little bit more, anyway. And in addition to that concept, the formation of the universe has certain strange events that took place that are still inexplicable today, but weren't known about at the time that I presented articles that said these inexplicable events would be discovered. So it's very interesting when we look at the formation and development of our understandings of time and space, that without metaphysics, and that's what I was using, to explain how the universe was developed, the physics of that time could not explain what was later to become what was explained. And so even though they don't know why, at least they've discovered that it's true, what I said was true. I hope you're following what I'm saying. So now again, it sounds like I'm just pat myself on the back. I'm trying to explain that now because today I'm doing somewhat of what I did in 1990, 91, 92, which is to go a little bit further than the present day in terms of understanding, which means that if things hold up to be the way they have, that 10 to 20 years from now, some people might say, maybe I'll be saying it, hey, those are things that guy on the radio, those are things that guy who wrote those books and, you know, those articles, et cetera, were saying back at the end of 2008. So maybe that will be the case. I'll leave it open. If you would like to, you know, say, hey, stop giving yourself so many strokes, or if you'd like to say something else on this show, you can do so by calling, if you're in the U.S., 877-876-5227. And if you're in Canada, try 888-815-9756. Love to hear from you while I'm on the air. Okay, so let's start off with my metaphysical explanation. I find that more interesting. Usually I start with the physics, but I think it's a little dry, particularly in this complicated area, to do that tonight. So I'm going to start with the metaphysical side, which I think is more interesting, and explain some things in terms of a model that hopefully will be explicable. Okay. So I would like you to think of this. You're God. We're all God. Okay. And we're going to create a universe in which the eventual development of life is a key component. And that life will eventually grow more of us, of a God, okay? And we need to do this in a way so that the life and everything else that exists within this new universe is capable of free thinking and free activity or free movement without being confined or completely controlled by our thought and by our movement itself. So we're going to make this a free choice universe, free will, and allow those things that choose to co-create with us, but those things that choose not to can create against us or just do whatever they want to do. And so we start off with this thought in general mind, and without going into where we came from, although I can explain that, I don't want to start that far back tonight, because I've done that in prior shows already, and we can do it for another night, because we'll just run out of time if I go back that far. So we're going to just start with the etheric physical part of what many people call our universe. The actual universe is six more, very larger dimensions of time and space that have more complexity to them. Tonight I'm only going to cover really the etheric physical, and I'll talk about the surrounding next dimension, which is actually quite a bit larger than the one we're in, where we go right after we die from this one. So I'll add that into my model. Okay, so what is the model going to be? Well, I'm going to try to make this as easy as possible. It may not be 100% accurate, but it's going to be as close as I get it with a model that people can picture. And speaking of pictures, my model is going to be the following. I want you to think of a perfectly round 10-foot frame, okay, that's going to hold a picture in it, but it's a round one. Most people think of picture frames as being rectangular or square, but this is a round one. Yeah, they make those too, of course. You've seen a few that look like that. This is a big one, kind of big anyway. I'm just going to call it 10 feet because I needed to have some size to it. I would like to think of it as bigger than usual because, after all, we are talking about what we call at least our part of the universe. So let's make it that big, if nothing less. Okay, and then there is yet no canvas that has been attached to this frame. There is a little tiny fraction of a piece of canvas right in the middle of the frame. Well, let's make it a quarter of an inch big. That's right in the middle. It's just sort of floating there. It isn't really attached to anything. And that's going to be the beginning point of where we're going to allow things to start happening, okay? So we got this little tiny piece of canvas that seems to just float right in the center of this frame, all right? And around our frame is a much bigger frame. I'm going to make this frame 100 feet in diameter. And this frame is three-dimensional, so it's actually like a globe. Okay, so it's a frame upon a frame. Each frame is going in every imaginable part of the globe. It has a piece of frame around it. And it's three-dimensional rather than two, but our frame is only two-dimensional. Okay. Now, that globe that is going around our flat 10-foot frame, the globe that is 100 feet, is the astral world. And it has a whole new dimension to it. It's huge by any standard compared to the frame that we are in or talking about. And it's already got on it a whole bunch of canvas that surrounds the entire globe or frame. And that frame is way different in the way the things can move around it in comparison to our frame, because things can only move in two directions on our frame, up or down, left or right, Whereas on the astral frame, things can go clear across, right through our frame, and go in all kinds of directions because there are three dimensions. There's depth, height, and width to it. So that has an extra dimension to it. And so things can have direction as they move about from one side to the other. If they're moving pretty quickly, they can jump off the surface of the frame and move from one side to the other and actually interpenetrate our frame of canvas. Okay? Are you following me so far? I hope so. I'm making this as easy as I can. Believe me, it could be a lot more complicated, so give me a little bit of space here, and I'll do what I can, okay? All right. Now, from five of the dimensions that this seven-dimension entire universe exists in, the two that I've just described are the two lowest dimensions. There are three higher ones beyond the astral world that contain energy, as well as the astral and the etheric physical. The etheric physical is the smallest dimension. That's the one that we're in. That's the one that's just a flat canvas. Now, there are energies in the other dimensions that literally don't act in ways gives them any dimensionality, any capability of functioning in any dimensionality other than the flat dimension that we here in this dimension exist in. And so they all gravitate down to us, okay? But there's no canvas for them to really be on because there's a lot of energy, an awful lot of energy, but there's no canvas for them to really start moving around on. So they literally go someplace, we'll call it outside of our canvas completely, and maybe in the back of it, but you really can't call it the back, we'll just say it's someplace else, and they concentrate into a very infinitely small point of energy and are held there, okay, until we decide that they're going to poke through. They're going to poke through that quarter inch of canvas and enter our dimension, the lowest dimension of time and space that they can exist in. And what these energies look like are extremely, extremely hot and very, very gaseous energies in which there is no form at all. They can't form anything because they're just too excited. They're just too hot to really do anything other than just be there. And they come through, they come right through, they burn right through the canvas, say, and they appear on the canvas as just super, super hot energies, okay? And instantly they change into seven types of energy that they kind of represented in the five other dimensions or the five dimensions total that they could have existed on before. They represent the seven kinds of expressions of how we as God want to create within our universe. And why don't you think of it as this? This is going to be a sand painting, okay? It's not going to be a painting. It's going to be a sand painting, and we have seven different kinds of sand. It starts off, though, initially as three only. The three kinds of sand, we can call them subatomic particles. And these three very special subatomic particles, which also are three different types of fields, all right, correspond to the three parts of our own mind. The first part is a particle that corresponds to freedom of thought and to freedom in general and purpose and all these other interesting things, creativity and creation. That's the first type of sand that comes out of this three particles and three fields and three sands that we're developing. And we'll give it a color. We're going to call it red. It actually vibrates to the color red. All right, so that's our first sand that's coming through. And then the next one that comes through is going to vibrate to are the second part of a mind, and it's going to represent givingness and planning, and it's going to represent consciousness. These are all words to kind of explain it, and we're going to call that blue. Okay, so we got red, and we got blue. And when you put these two together, if they do come together, they produce light. But for right now, they're not doing that. They just pop through, and they don't, and so they're just kind of in and out producing red and blue, but they're not really coming together. Okay, and there is a third sand. There's a third sand. And the third sand that comes through, the third field, produces a very interesting color, because this color is a yellow, but sometimes when it is part of life or about to produce life, it actually turns more green than yellow, but that's a different issue. And so we really got three colors, three different kinds of particles popping around, very interesting. And so some neat kinds of themes are really taking place here, which are quite fascinating as we examine this whole thing. And these three particles have three fields, or the three fields have three particles, depending upon how you want to look at it. And they're not even quite particles yet. They maybe start as fields and then become particles. Some people may argue that. It's hard to say. It's kind of the chicken and the egg thing. Now, the particles and fields actually have been found to exist in physics today. And one of them is called a boson, and it doesn't really matter what their names are. But the important thing is that they actually have been found to exist. And so the universe starts off as these three pieces of sand for our sand painting. Okay. And it turns out that when the yellow particle tends to break off from the other two and separate, there's four more kinds of particles that start to exist, and fields. And so there ends up being a total of seven. Just like we had originally planned, there's going to be seven kinds of distinctive colors. They're the same colors of the rainbow, by the way. And these seven types of sand, as soon as they all exist, start developing a repulsion to each other. Because although they are super hot, and although they actually tended to gravitate together when they weren't on our campus, they were very gravitated together because they're infinitely small, they suddenly now are moving apart from each other. And the reason they're moving apart is that although they still kind of could gravitate towards each other, they initially find that as soon as they're not together anymore, their individual fields are antagonistic, in a sense, to each other. And as long as they all exist in trying to be the same kind of space, they actually can't exist all together in the same space and time, because they are not intelligent. They are unintelligent. They are so unintelligent, they can't communicate with each other, they can't express anything that makes any sense to each other, so the only thing they can do is try to run away from each other. And they very, very quickly start to move apart. And as they do, they immediately start losing some of their quality of being a field, being a field of energy. So they start losing some of this quality. So effectively, they start cooling, because as energy loses some of its quality of being energy, it produces a cooling effect by our definition of heat and cool. As they move apart, we decide that we've got to give them a little room. As a matter of fact, we give them a lot of room. And we decide, we're gone now, okay, that if we do anything other than equally distribute the canvas, making it perfectly smooth, uncreated canvas, if we did anything other than that, we would interfere. We would interfere with the sand's ability to create on its own. And we don't want to do that. We want this sand that's going to create our painting to do so on its own. Meaning that through its own properties of existence, it has to find a way for it to do what it's going to do by moving from a state of total unintelligence, no intelligence at all, meaning that it can't communicate with any other parts of these other six parts besides itself, of kinds of energy. It can't produce anything at the very beginning. We're going to give it an opportunity to do that, but without us dictating anything other than the total size of our sand painting. Okay. So we're going to stretch the canvas now way out to the sides, all right, making a perfectly circular canvas, right, perfect circular, that is perfectly intelligent, but there's nothing to intelligize about because we're not dictating where and what this sand's going to be doing. We're just allowing it to do it. Now, as soon as we expand out our canvas, it does something weird to the sand. For about 300,000 of what we'll call years of time, the sand very quickly expands way out, way, way out from itself. All the different particles go kind of go whoosh, all over the place. And as they do that, they are not yet able to communicate much of anything, but they start cooling down, and because they start cooling down, they get closer together to those things that are right next to them, but they're spreading very quickly away from all the other particles that are not very much like themselves. And this is producing an odd effect. They're actually moving way faster than the speed of light. I mean, thousands of times faster than the speed of light, while we expand our canvas to make sure that this whole process is going to have plenty of space that will not interfere with it. So we have to be completely ubiquitous in expanding the canvas to the maximum level without creating any encumbrance. And this is a very intelligent thing we do, is that we acted in an intelligent way by not interfering and creating intelligence in the sand. We allow the sand to do that on its own. All right. So about 300,000 years this goes on for, while we're, expanding the whole thing out to this perfect circular but two-dimensional circular painting that's going to exist. Okay, now the sand, after we are done, we're done creating our canvas, we leave it alone, so the canvas is there, okay. When you guys get to use it, that's fine, if you get to use it. And so the sand starts, in the beginning the sand is relatively circular, actually. But it's kind of circular, but just a fog of nothingness. Eventually, some of the sand starts making things that we call atoms, okay? And the atoms have some particles, one of the three kinds, actually, that are kind of enlightened. We could call them electrons, and they produce photons, which are very much light. They actually, when they move from one state of existence to another, when they become excited and creative because of the ability to recognize and communicate with some other electrons, when they do that, they produce a particle called a photon, and they actually produce light. Now, what is the light? The light is really two of the three kinds of particles or fields of energy interacting together. And those two fields are the first and second parts of our own mind. When they join together and produce these two fields, they are actually producing light, and they can only do that when they interact as part of an atom with some other atom. So as soon as they do that, there's an intelligence going on between these particles now in these fields, and light is being produced for the very first time in the universe. There's no light before that. And so we can't see back before this about 300,000 years ago, because 300,000 years from the inception of the beginning of the process, because there was no light. It was just like a fog and it's darkness. Very interesting kind of thing going on there. Okay, so no light at all. Now, theoretically, at the very beginning of the universe, because everything was together, theoretically there probably was some light, but it went away as soon as the whole thing broke apart. So you could say the universe started from light, but instantly became darkness, and then for a few hundred thousand years was dark, and then it went back to start producing some light again, because now we had atoms. we had atoms that were starting to interact with each other in ways that were somewhat intelligent. And the very first atoms that started to interact produced the very simplest kind of substance or form. It wasn't just energy anymore. It was actually a form. And that very first form is called hydrogen. It's the very first kind. And it produces the very first kind of sand that can be painted with and produce something that stays intact on the canvas. So you can now see hydrogen, and it's red. And you can see it on the canvas, and it's clear that that's where it is, and you can see kind of a redness that's coming from it. Kind of interesting stuff. And one of the other colors that gets produced is kind of a thing called helium, which comes out of the hydrogen sometimes as a little more complex to it, because there's more of electrons that are jumping around between other electrons and other atoms, and producing this element called helium. And interestingly, the energies that are producing this are the interactions of the nucleuses of the atoms, which are called, in metaphysical terms, elemental parts of the atom, and the electrons, which are called devonic parts of the atom. Devonic means that the electrons are more willing to kind of cooperate and share, literally share, with other atoms, whereas the nuclei do not want to do that. They're sort of saying, hey, I'm not going to share with any other atom unless you really make me. You know, if you electrons can get me to do it, fine. And if you can't, I'm just going to stick it out in my atom, and I'm not going to play with the other nuclei and the other atoms unless I'm really forced to. But you see, the electrons kind of do that. They kind of get the idea, well, we know a way to make it happen. We'll use the gravity that you elemental energies in the nuclei produce to create a thing, a big giant thing that eventually produces enough of gravity to force the nuclei to start getting together with other nuclei and produce a thing called fusion. And when they do that, boy, do they get together, they produce a thing called a star. So the very first stars in this whole system our sand painting are created by the electrons eventually producing enough hydrogen so that it gravitates together, and some helium as well, and produces the very first stars. Yeah, that's what's going on, no kidding. And when the stars are created, the stars start producing prodigious amounts of light. Very interesting stuff. Well, at any rate, we're about at our midpoint, so we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, I'm going to explain a lot more about how this whole system is taking place. And we'll do that in about 2.5 minutes from now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the wise, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about revealing new information about time and space. And if you don't know much about physics, this show will probably help to explain some things that exist today in physics, but it will go beyond that. So hopefully that'll help you understand how our universe works. Okay, so getting back to what I was explaining, we have our sand plate painting coming along, and the seven kinds of sand are eventually producing all kinds of stars. Now, for the most part, you should be aware that there really are, as far as the stars are concerned, mostly just the first two and possibly the third part of the sand that are creating the stars. And the other four types, there's only a small amount of those elements available in the early, early universe. Okay, and this is all taking place over, like, a billion years of time. It's taking a lot of time for these different types of sands to get together, producing enough hydrogen, and the hydrogen eventually starts to gravitate. And it doesn't gravitate in a way that is highly intelligent. It's only moderately intelligent. So consequently, you have big gaseous clouds of some elements, which we'll call like dust, and a lot of hydrogen and a lot of helium. And these clouds just sort of float around, and they are moving. They're moving because in the initial part of the universe, they very quickly started moving away from each other. So these clouds are all running away from each other that do gravitate together, but they stay in groups. They stay in groups because their gravity affects some elements of other clouds, whereas in some cases their speed overcomes the gravity of other groups of clouds, and so they're kind of moving away from each other in groups of clouds, and eventually some of the clouds become stars, or parts of the clouds become stars, and eventually enough of those stars kind of group together, again, through their own gravity, and they start to spin. The reason they start to spin is that the gravity that they produce is not even, because the only thing that's even in the universe is our own mind, the mind of God, that produced the canvas that they're on. That's entirely perfect, but they are far from perfect, and they're all kind of fighting for their own dominance, so you end up with the kind of thing where one side of a cloud is more dense than another side, and as a result, it has more gravity, and it produces eventually a kind of a roundish, more egg-shaped galaxy that eventually starts to spin because one side is a little stronger than the other. There's unevenness, and as it spins, it starts to flatten out, and eventually it produces some stars, and some of those stars eventually burn out and explode. And then new stars are created from the material that those stars produced. And eventually you get stars that turn out to be things called black holes. And then those black holes start joining together towards the center of each one of these, we'll call them proto-galaxies. And the black holes really accelerate the process of the galaxy, producing many, many more stars much more quickly and a lot more gravity, because black holes are very gravitational. And very strange things start to happen. I mean, literally, you start forming galaxy clusters. You start forming some of the galaxies start joining together, and the centers of the galaxies, which are giant black holes, start joining together. All kinds of interesting things happen. And all this is going on our painting. Our sand painting has all of these bits and pieces of sand now forming all of these interesting features. Now, the interesting part about this is that it's forming kind of an egg-shaped pattern and with parts like a spider web type of looking figure to the galaxies. They tend to move along these spider webs because that they are starting to group together even though they're moving apart. And they're not moving apart perfectly because they're not perfectly, there's no perfect intelligence among any part of this, any part of the form parts of the galaxies or anything. So they tend to become more egg-shaped than they become perfectly circular. Even though our painting ultimately has a shape of perfection in circularness. And it's surrounded by a perfect dimension of astral perfection, which is very, very spherical. But nonetheless, the painting in, at this stage, after a billion years, even a couple billion years, is quite egg-shaped and has little spider arms to it. And some parts are very dense with energies, and most parts are actually very vacant of energy. And this continues to move on. And as it does, more and more of these smaller galaxies become larger. They are moving further and further apart from each other, the ones that aren't affected by each other's gravity, that is. The ones that are affected by each other's gravity are actually moving towards each other. And this is because the thought that we put into the whole situation allowed this to happen. If we didn't have a background, we'll call it, to the whole situation in our thought that said we want all parts of the activity to be equal that we add into it. If we didn't give that to the original sand painting, then it would not be possible to have any of the things that I just described actually take place. And it wouldn't even be possible for the original painting to have gone much faster than the speed of light. As a matter of fact, that's the thing called cosmic inflation, and it's still not understood. It's just a thing they invented, the word, because they don't know why these things took place. They know they happen now. They just don't know why. And again, this was all predicted by things that I wrote quite some time ago. For those of you who are familiar with Life, Sin, and Meaning, I really wrote that book in about 93, about the spring of 93, even though it didn't get published in 99. And so if you look at the whole process, you begin to see that I was explaining that cosmic inflation was going to be discovered, but that at that time they didn't even know it existed. That's one of those ideas I was suggesting at the beginning of the show. Okay, so cosmic inflation is when the universe, things in the universe, the beginning forms, before there was actually anything we could call even galaxies, just like atoms are starting to form. And even before atoms existed, those energies move much, much, thousands of times faster than the speed of light. But that's kind of contradictory to the theories of relativity, which is what Albert Einstein came up with, that they shouldn't have been able to do that. So there's some law that doesn't make sense, and the reason the law doesn't make sense is that they were responding to our background thought of making our canvas into the ultimate full size. Now, our canvas, in this example, represents the ultimate of perfected time and space without it having yet been co-created by the life that we were going to eventually produce through producing all of these different elements that eventually will develop into life. So what's going on in our model is that we are providing the canvas, but the real painter is inside the picture. It's not outside. It's not us painting the picture. We're just providing a canvas. And in providing the canvas, we produce this impetus of vast movement that's unintelligent and allow that vast movement of energies and form to then, on their own, create life, and that life will eventually produce a picture that does have intelligence in it and is co-created with us. But all we're doing is providing the initial push, the initial place for things to take place. Our time and space is incomplete, even though it's perfect. It's perfect in terms that it allows complete intelligence and communication, provided that that which co-creates with our thought chooses to design itself so that it is both spherical and eventually can get off the canvas and become multidimensional. If it can't get off the canvas and become multidimensional, it will never be able to fully understand its own creator, and it will never be able to co-create in a way which is really intelligent, because we're off the canvas. The only way we can make it perfectly spherical, the only way we can make it so that everything that's on the canvas can have its own choices, is by being off the canvas and knowing us. So the life that's on the canvas has to eventually figure it all out, you see. It has to discover where we are and who we are for it to be able to create in a fully and totally intelligent way with all the other life that's on the canvas with it. I hope you're following me. I hope you are. I know that was like huge. Some of you are just going, what did he say? You know, if you missed this, you can, in a day or two, you can go and listen to it again. And you can say, yeah, I want to hear this show again, and I'm going to take notes this time or something. This guy's, you know, he's talking about stuff. It sounds interesting, but it's pretty far out there, right? Okay. So, now the interesting thing about the black holes that I mentioned, you know, the black holes, they really are kind of holes in the canvas. And what those black holes do is they start to communicate with the astral dimension and the dimensions beyond the astral dimension. The space they create is actually a dimensional space that's greater than the space that the canvas itself represents. So black holes are ways for us to start discovering that there are other dimensions of time and space other than the ones that we're in, which is the surface of the canvas, you see. Very interesting stuff, I hope. I hope you got it. Okay, so now let's look at this from an even broader perspective, okay? The eventual development of our sand painting is dependent upon how the different galaxies produce life within themselves and how that life is able to communicate with life within the galaxy and eventually outside the galaxy, and then beyond that, life that exists in other dimensions of time and space. And the only way that life can do that is to actually travel through the other dimensions of time and space to even get to the other galaxies, much less to get to life that exists in those other dimensions. Did you follow what I just said? I hope so. Okay, so what I'm saying is that, interestingly, the only way we can even get across our own galaxy or get to anything that exists beyond our galaxy, even to stars or even reasonably close to us, is to travel through the space that is in the astral and dimension and beyond, than to try to move through the surface of the painting, because on the surface of the painting we are confined to the speed of light. We cannot go faster than the speed of light, and in truth, we couldn't even go near the speed of light, because you need an infinite amount of energy just to go to the speed of light. The infinite would be all the energy in the universe. So we can't do that, and it's not possible. And so all we can do is we can go through a shortcut, you might say, going off the canvas. And if we go off the canvas, we can get anywhere we want to be on the canvas in very little time. Very little time. But if we stay on the canvas, it will take longer than we would ever have to be able to travel to even the next galaxy. So, and the next galaxy is very, very close to us compared to the furthest galaxy from us, because they've all been moving apart for 13.7 billion years, at least in clusters they have. Some of the very closest galaxies, because gravity overcomes their urge to move apart, actually move towards each other and may actually crash together. Our closest galaxy, which is a neighbor called Andromeda, is moving towards us. And within a few million years, will actually touch us. And the two galaxies will join together, producing an even larger black hole in the middle of our galaxy, which will get us even closer to being understanding and in contact with other dimensions of time and space that we may be able to move through, if we know what we're doing, that is. Not such an easy job, no. Okay, so let me continue on. Let me continue on with my model. I hope my model is not confusing you more than helping you. This is not an easy model. Okay, so our painting right now is a few inches in diameter and more egg-shaped than it is circular. It's egg-shaped because it's kind of not evenly dispersed because the amount of intelligent activity that the life that has been created in each galaxy, in each star system, et cetera, and planets, though that life has not been very intelligent yet in comparison to what it eventually will be. So the whole, what we call our universe of energy that is creating life, is still pretty backward and doesn't have a lot of intelligence. It doesn't cooperate and share together very well. It doesn't plan very well. It does a lot of things that unfortunately waste time and energy. So we have this issue going on continually. And that produces a picture which is kind of distorted. And it doesn't really resemble the pure circular nature that God created. And if we're thinking ourselves as God, that we created, to the original pattern of our painting, which is a perfect 10-foot circle. And remember, the universe is only a few inches in size right now, compared to that universe, which is, well, it would be 120 inches in size if we thought of it in terms of inches. So much bigger, right? Very interesting, most fascinating. Okay, so what does this all mean in terms of what physics says? Well, this model that I just presented to you in a kind of a very, very, we'll call it shorthand way, is completely consistent, 100% consistent with what is presently known in physics. But it explains much better, because it explains why the physics that exists today is finding a lot of anomalies, a lot of crises, because there's no explanation for the way the physics works if you don't have the first two parts of our mind, which is spiritual thought, involved in the process. It just doesn't, if you only have the third part, which is movement itself and energy, yes, we can see that there's energy and some of it looks intelligent and some of it looks unintelligent, but we couldn't quite grasp why that's the case, because we don't see that there's any thought behind what the energy is doing, that the energy itself has some semblance of thought, although it's small, in what it's doing. And the universe looks helter-skelter and strange. Yet, when we examine it, really, if we're physicists today and we examine the universe, we see that, you know what, it isn't as random as it should be. As a matter of fact, it shouldn't be clumping together. It shouldn't be forming these spider webs. It shouldn't have accelerated suddenly about 300,000 years after, during the first 300,000 years it was formed. It shouldn't have done any of those things. It should be literally just kind of flying apart in a kind of spherical way, and it would not be anything more than that, and it shouldn't be making stars. It shouldn't be doing any of the stuff that it's doing. As a matter of fact, the stuff it is doing is antithetical to our theories of science, because although there's a thing called quantum mechanics, even quantum mechanics doesn't explain how these things could actually take place, because the mechanics in quantum energy suggest that because of randomness, you have a thing called cancellation, and you would end up with a pretty homogeneous and a nondescript universe in which we wouldn't have much of anything. You certainly wouldn't have galaxies that are kind of in numbers of 30 or more that are kind of hanging out together. That would make much sense. And you wouldn't have much of any of the features that we consider really giving our universe a creative edge and the ability to produce great and new ways of existing. But when you include the metaphysical ideas, you've got a completely different picture. You do have a universe that is both creative, that has the opportunity to co-create with its creator, that is multidimensional, even though we aren't aware of those dimensions at this point, unless you astral travel, unless you believe that these things really exist, or you have had experience with them, or you test them out. And, or if you read some of the things that have been written about all this, and you kind of can see how it works together, and you can say, yeah, that model really does make sense to me. But for a lot of people, they're confused, particularly scientists, because they like to look at everything in terms of an energy model, and we're talking about something different than just pure energy. We're talking about thought and reason, and we're talking about spirit. And those things, and remember, spirit just means the thought of God. And so those things are what is really controlling what is going on within this vast universe. Now, I'm going to run out of time, and I would like to prep. I'm going to continue the show till next week and talk about where this model goes to and what are the struggles, what does all this mean in terms of us, and how does this work out in terms of the future, and why is it so important that you create a universe the way it has been created rather than some other way? Because there are other ways to do it. The only problem is it doesn't turn out that it develops itself into intelligent activity at the end. It turns out to be kind of a Mickey Mouse nonsense thing. And there's not much reason to produce a universe that does that, particularly if you're God and you want to produce something that co-creates with you, which is life itself. It doesn't work. So I want you to think about that. And while you're doing so, I want to mention to you that this Sunday, if you have a chance, listen in to 1170 AM if you're in the Boston, Norfolk, Providence, Rhode Island, any parts of that part of the country, listen in to 1170. Yeah, sorry about that. The radio station cut me off, but it was all an accident. Okay, so I'm saying if you can, listen to 1170 AM from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, this Sunday, and I'm live. You can listen and you can call in, and it's that's WDISAM.com if you have a chance to listen and you are not in the Providence, Boston, Norfolk area, and or if you want to listen on the Internet, okay? So please do that. If you are in the Phoenix metropolitan area on Monday, December 15th, that's this Monday, you can listen to me, and I'll be over at Borders Books and Music and Mesa Fiesta talking about the science of sexual energy. So join in if you can and come in, and it's 7 p.m., from 7 p.m. to 8:15 p.m. over at Borders Books and Music, Mesa Fiesta, 1361 South Alma School Road over in Mesa. Love to see you there, so please stop by and say hello. You know, why not? So hopefully you can do that. Next week we'll continue our show. We will continue it dealing with more about where this leads us, what all this means in terms of physics and metaphysics, about what time and space really are, and I'll bring it to a conclusion hopefully at the end of next week's show. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.